you already have two books about Einstein, you know, one describing that he's a plagiarist and the other with the detailed physics to prove it. Would you say this new book is something different, or is it those two books with some additional material?
It's those two books with a great deal of additional material and several new themes.
Yeah, in your book, it's making it appear as if a group of Jews have been trying for centuries to conquer the world. But the Jews that I personally know don't have any idea that such a plot exists. So how would you describe who these particular Jews are?
It's always been Jewish leadership, and it's always been Judaism itself. The Jewish prophets created a mythology that predicted that eventually the Jews would rule a world government, and that there would be a Jewish Messiah who would come and judge and then exterminate all non-Jews. And since God failed to intervene in that, they have always been trying to personally intervene in world affairs to try to bring those prophecies to fruition.
Would you say this is like a large percentage of Jewish leaders? When you're thinking like rabbis, I suppose, right?
No. It depends on what period of history we're discussing, but in modern history, most rabbis have been very opposed to human intervention into God's domain, which is the fulfillment of messianic prophecy. It was always the wealthy Jewish leaders who were pushing to become the king. Judaism has religious as well as political aspects to it. And the Messiah is a political figure for the Jews, not a religious figure. He is very dissimilar to the Christian view of Jesus as Messiah.
So when you say Jewish leaders, you're really thinking more like Jewish wealthy businessmen or people in Hollywood, that type of leader, rather than the ones at the local synagogue?
It depends also on what issues you're referring to. There is a tribal unity that many Jews feel and always have felt. And even though they're not aware of what exactly is going on, they do feel that they gain advantages by acting collectively. So they may not be aware of all the particulars, but they are aware that it's in their interest to go along with whatever the major movements are. And they have writers, and they are generally very well educated and very literate, and they pay attention to politics, so they're very involved in things.
Okay, so Jewish leaders then really kind of, it's not so much the synagogue as opposed to like the bankers, the wealthy businessmen, the people that are out there writing the books and doing the influence over other Jews then, right?
Since World War II, it has started to spill into the synagogues, but most Jews are secular, so the synagogue doesn't have that great of an influence over the broader Jewish community. But since World War II and the horrifying events of World War II and the shock that it had when Jews were just beginning to broadly assimilate has had a negative impact on the broader Jewish community and forced them more and more into segregation and into it reawoke the ancient mythology that Jews are perpetual victims and have to segregate in order to survive. So it is, again, filtering into the synagogues and more broadly into Jewish self-perception, I would say, is the strongest motivating factor that we have to fight when you speak about the broad Jewish community. But the Jews at the very top, the Kabbalistic Jews, are following an ancient tradition based on the Messianic prophecies as they have been interpreted through Kabbalistic and Talmudic writings.
Now, these Jews you say that are at the top, if this plot is centuries old, that means they've got to constantly come up with new members. So how would you describe this? Is this just from one family? You know, the families are just, it's their sons and then their sons and so on? Or are they bringing new members in through some method?
They have the battle plan is spelled out in the prophecies of Isaiah, the prophecies of Ezekiel, the prophecies of Daniel, and in the Talmud and Kabbalistic writing. so whoever pursues that literature, if they view that those stories as a plan that they are to carry out, it doesn't matter who they are. That's how they were able to pass it from the tribe of Judah to the Ashkenazim.
So they're looking for people who just follow those particular writings.
Well, Jews, if you look at the Bible, lineages are always very important, and they keep track of familial and tribal lineages. Those names, Cohen, Benjamin, Judah, those are all the tribes of Israel, and they're very sensitive to familial lineages, and they have a long history of carefully marrying rabbis to wives of other, daughters of other rabbis, and they're very particular about who they marry and how they marry. That's an ancient Jewish tradition. So they're clannish, and they establish themselves and manifest that clannishness through the way they intermarry, and the bankers intermarry with one another. Now, the history which has brought about the events that we're dealing with today mostly evolved out of Shabbatai Zevi and the Frankists down through the Rothschild family. And they were the predominant force by far in bringing about all the events that we are dealing with today.
What would you say about the people controlling the media today in America and Europe, since they seem to be helping them an awful lot? Would you say they are directly involved with them? Like, if you look at NBC, CBS, the New York Times, and so on, you know, the people running these.
The media system evolved out of the dogmatic system of both the Catholic Church and Judaism, and the Catholic Church inherited it from Judaism. The idea of censorship and that God's laws are absolute, and you require a nihil obstat to be able to publish anything. Now, when the Jews were emancipated, with their great wealth, they were able to buy up all the media outlets, and it became kind of a caste system for Jews to go into the media business, even if it wasn't wealth-producing. They viewed it as an obligation to fulfill the Jewish mission. And the Jewish mission is to destroy other cultures and Judaize other cultures and to eliminate all other religions other than Judaism. So it is it's a manifestation of both religious and political and tribal views. It's a very broad and powerful force within the Jewish community and has been for thousands of years.
And then you also mention in your book, though, that they also plan on not just taking over the non-Jews, but the Jews they don't regard as, part of their group. From a Jew's point of view, how would they know if they are one of the targets? What are these people? How would you say they differentiate between one Jew and another?
There are different religious, cultural, and geographical distinctions, as well as what they would view as racial distinctions. They have the Sephardim and the Ashkenazim, and they also have a very snobbish attitude towards wealth, and they look down very much upon poor people, especially upon poor, uneducated Jews. The Sephardim were always the elite, and they were involved in America from the very beginning, from the time that Columbus landed. And they have always looked down upon the Ashkenazim as being not really Jews. And that has reversed itself since the Ashkenazim poured out of Poland and Russia into America into the 1880s. They were able to gain political power and great wealth. And they have basically controlled what's going on in Israel, and they attacked the Sephardim. But during World War II, the Jews of Germany were very assimilated. And the primary target is always going to be those Jews who are most assimilated because they pose the greatest threat to the tribe. The primary goal of the tribe is to survive to the point where the Messiah returns. And then when the Messiah returns, he will eliminate all non-Jews so there will no longer be a threat of assimilation.
Oh, I see. So Jews that are marrying non-Jews are in trouble, I guess.
They always have been. There are several stories in the Bible where religious figures are told to mass murder any of the tribe who intermarry with non-Jews. And God becomes outraged whenever the Jews begin to intermarry. And the excuse that is always given is that God is a jealous God. And when Jews intermarry with other peoples, they adopt the other religions, which angers God. And that's why the Jews were sent into exile. The northern tribes were sent into exile up through Assyria and in the first exile. And then the southern tribes, the northern tribes never really existed. But the southern tribes of Judah and Benjamin were sent into exile in Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar. And it was supposedly God's punishment. And that's when they lost the covenant. And that is why Jews like Naturikarta say that they cannot return to Israel because they have not repented for their sins of disobeying God.
So those particular ones, the Naturikarta Jews, they're in serious trouble also then, right?
Yes.
If these people get control, that's the end of them.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Well, they're on the...
They are tolerant of the religious argument that is laid out in the Talmud, I believe in Ketubot 111a. And there are three things that the Jews are forbidden to do. And the primary one is that they're forbidden to return to Israel en masse.
Oh.
And all Jews will respect, all religious Jews will respect that religious argument. They're still Jews, and they're Jews who are not assimilating, so they're not in that great of danger. But they were in danger when the Nazis took over because they were strongly opposed to Zionism. But now that the State of Israel is a reality, they don't pose much of a threat.
When I look, though, at people like in the media or Larry Silverstein or Dov Zakheim, none of these are the ones that, you know, wear the little yarmulkes or the curly hair around their ears. They're not exactly what you'd call Orthodox Jews. So if these people, those are the people that are in there, I suppose you would say Silverstein's in this group, right?
I don't know, but I do know that Jews who are highly successful tend to be clannish and tend to view themselves as Jews above all else. And that is political more than it is religious. And it's also got racist elements. I'm not talking about the people you name, but I'm talking about the general culture that Judaism has created from the beginning of segregation, supremacy, and snobbishness towards other people.
Yeah, I see. So these are not necessarily the type
but
we would recognize.
You're naming are not. The people who are really at the top are trillionaires. And when you talk about billionaires or millionaires, you're talking about lesser figures who are in the public eye. And those who are in the public eye are not the true leader.
But the trillionaires are what? The Rothschilds? How many others are there?
I don't know how many there are.
But you think there may be more than just that Rothschilds family?
Well, the Rothschilds, the Warburgs, the Schiffs, they intermarried and they are very clannish and very powerful. And there is a strong religious element in what they do. They did not go to all the trouble of stealing Palestine from the Turkish Empire and then taking it away from its original inhabitants for no reason. And the reason they did it is to fulfill the messianic prophecies of Judaism. And that is also why they want to create a world government, because that's one of the aspects of Judaism.
And of course they want to be in control of this world government.
They think that when they gain control of the world, all the other nations will be destroyed. God will descend to Mount Zion in Jerusalem and share the empire of the world with the King of the Jews, and will instruct the King of the Jews on how to conduct world affairs. That is what Judaism teaches. And that is what Jews, that is the reason why Jews have kept themselves segregated for 2,500 years from the rest of humanity.
So these people are religious to some extent, even though they're not wearing the necessarily looking like the Orthodox Jews. You are saying
they are products of Judaism.
They are following some of the teachings.
They are a part of the cultural heritage of those beliefs. And you have to remember that it was only very recently that Jews were emancipated and that secular Jewish movements took over.
You also mentioned in your book that Henry Ford from what you can see, showed no signs of any concern about Jews until about 1920 or so. And you say you think it was because that was when he discovered the Protocols of Zion?
No. He was a pacifist. And traditionally, pacifists have come to the awareness that Jewish leadership are warmongers. And what happened with Henry Ford was he wanted to keep America out of the war, and he wanted to end the war because it was so senseless. The war unfolded in such a strange way where the Pan-Slavics were pitted against the Pan-Germans, and then the Germans had to defend their rear flank in Belgium, and then when they sought to defend their rear flank in Belgium, England and France inexplicably claimed that they had treaties which forced them to declare war on Germany, and that's how the World War began. And it was completely senseless. It was pointless. And it was a complete setup. Archduke Ferdinand was murdered by Jewish anarchists. The whole thing was contrived. And Henry Ford set out to bring about peace. He was a strong pacifist and a humanitarian. And he created an endeavor called the Peace Ship, which was a steamer that went from the United States, I think first to Denmark or one of the northern countries. And he was going to meet with the heads of state of Europe and try to negotiate a peace in 1915. And he was hopeful that he would be able to bring about peace by Christmas. Now, when he undertook that voyage, he met with Herman Bernstein, who was a Jewish reporter. He would report sometimes in the New York Times, and I think he was a stable reporter with Jewish World or something. And he met with Razika Schwimmer, who was really a wonderful woman. She was Jewish, and she was one of the leading pacifists in the world. And she was the force behind the peace ship voyage. Now, Henry Ford later said that it was on that trip that Herman Bernstein and Razika Schwimmer told him that the Jewish bankers had started the war and that the war would not end until they decided that it would end, and that if he really wanted to accomplish anything, he would have to talk to them. And then Herman Bernstein left the trip, and the whole trip was sabotaged when he arrived in Europe. Everybody got the flu, and the whole thing fell apart, and he was made a laughingstock in the American press, because the American politicians wanted to profiteer off of the war, and they started to push for America to enter into the war. But Woodrow Wilson came up for re-election, and he promised to keep America out of the war. And then he stabbed everyone in the back and immediately brought us into the war when he was re-elected. And Henry Ford became very bitter about that. And he said that, I'm going to do something about this. But since he was so patriotic, he produced war materials at no profit throughout the duration of the war. But once the war was over, he set about to find out who was behind all this and to create some kind of resolution. And when he did that, he bought the newspaper, the Dearborn Independent in Michigan, came up for sale, and he bought it. And then he worked with a man named Cameron to produce articles and to investigate what Jewish Americans were up to and what Jewish World Finance was up to and their involvement in the war. And there was a great fear at the time that the Bolsheviks were going to take over the world, because it was well known in America the horrific things that they had done in Russia, and it was well known that Jacob Schiff was behind it all.
And it was also known that the Bolsheviks were part of this Jewish group?
Absolutely. It was very well known. It was proven. The American government was very aware of it. And the American government took the protocols of the Elders of Zion very seriously and had it immediately translated.
It was our own government translated it?
Absolutely. Dr. Harris Holton was U.S. Army intelligence, I think. And he had, I think, his secretary or one of his connection secretaries translated it. And the government took it very seriously, and Louis Brandeis and Louis Marshall tried to get the American government to beg off of it and to not instigate congressional hearings about it.
So then they suppressed it then?
They suppressed it. But there were hearings about what happened in Russia. And the American government was very aware of the fact that Jews were behind it all.
There were actually hearings at Congress, you mean?
I think there were Senate hearings, yes.
Wow. So then this has been suppressed tremendously, because even growing up in school out here, I didn't hear such things.
No, and you won't hear. You won't hear about it. But there were major, the Chicago Tribune published articles saying that there was a Jewish conspiracy to take over the world. The London Times was very concerned about the protocols and published an article called The Jewish Peril.
Well, what has happened to those papers since? Well, at that time, then, I guess they weren't under the control of these particular Jews that were trying to promote it then. They must have been much more independent at that time.
The newspapers formed a conglomerate around 1912 to get the banking so-called reform laws passed. J.P. Morgan, who was a Rothschild agent, set up a cartel of the most influential newspapers in America to push through the so-called reforms that became the Federal Reserve Act. And all that was worked out 1907, 1908 on Jekyll Island between Varburg, Senator Aldrich, and a couple others. But at any rate, the First World War is where the newspaper propaganda machine really took off. And the British basically controlled American propaganda throughout the war.
The British?
The British.
Not they the said, Jewish British? You mean like the, just the...
Well, the Jews had had strong influence in the British government for centuries. They controlled the central bank, the Jewish royal family... Freudian slip. The British royal family considered themselves to be Jews. Queen Victoria thought she was descended from King David and would bear the Messiah. There was a heavy involvement. The British had been taught for centuries that they were descended from one of the lost tribes of the Jews who had been brought to England on Phoenician ships. So the Jews had effectively controlled the British government for centuries.
And you say they were also having a tremendous influence over the American media?
Oh, absolutely. It's well known. I think the guy's name was Gilbert Parker and Lord Northcliffe. And another guy, Creel, who was an American, was involved with them. And they sent over a propaganda department.
Well, then
Lord Northcliffe owned the London Times and several other influential British publications, and he was in charge of British propaganda during the war.
Well, then
and that's when the general vilification of Germans started. Before that happened, Americans were resentful of British because of the American Revolution, the War of 1812, and the general British arrogance towards America.
Oh, so you think it was their propaganda that then made them the heroes and the Germans the bad guys?
Absolutely. It was filled with lies of how Germans were crucifying people on trees and using cadavers to produce war materials and all other kinds of lies.
Well, then how did the Chicago Tribune and the British newspaper talk about the Protocols of Zion so late? Were they just not under total control yet?
They weren't. And the Chicago Tribune had been publishing articles against Rothschild intervention in America from, I think, shortly before the Civil War onwards. And you have to realize how horrifying what the Bolsheviks were doing was to the rest of the world. The fact that they were burning food and deliberately starving tens of millions of people to death horrified people. And the Jews also wanted that to be very well known because they wanted to, not the Jews, but the Zionist Jews, wanted to threaten the rest of the world with the idea that they had to make a choice between Zionism and Bolshevism. And a good example of that was Winston Churchill's article in the Illustrated Sunday Herald, where he offered the world a choice between Zionism and Bolshevism. But his article followed on the heels of an article by Chaim Weizmann. And a lot of people think that Churchill was an anti-Semite, but he wasn't. He was a devout Zionist. And what he wanted to do was to persuade the Western nations that the solution to Bolshevism was to get the Jews into Palestine. Because Theodor Herzl and many others had said that when the Jews rise up, they have the terrible power of the purse, and when they fall down in society, they become the heads of all the revolutionary movements. So the offer was, you either have to let us have Palestine and be Zionists, or we're going to destroy the whole world with Bolshevism. And they made that an open threat. And the world took that threat very seriously. And it was very serious. Bavaria became a Soviet republic after the First World War.
And now, was it known that the Zionists were also behind the Bolsheviks?
It was known that the Jewish prophecies called for world government. And Bolshevism was a political movement that was fulfilling Jewish prophecies. And the First World War was also seen in a very prophetic sense, that it was the war to end all wars, which is a prophecy in Isaiah 2:4, that after a great, horrific war, there will be everlasting peace.
If the Zionists were behind Bolshevism, would you say that's true, first of all?
Yes, they were. We know it's true because Jacob Schiff, who was an agent of the Rothschild, financed Bolshevism and sent Trotsky and Lenin in to take it over.
Well, if they're behind that, and then at the same time they're telling people, in order to protect you from it, you got to come to us. I mean, they're creating the enemy, and they're also providing the solution to it.
And they're creating wars, which drive nations into debt. And debt becomes a perpetual source of revenue for them.
Well, this means that that same group of people, they are the communists, they're the right, they're the left, or the, whatever you want to call them, they're all sides.
It's wrong to ever say that those are their sincere political beliefs. Those are their means for controlling other people, and that's how you get rid of the paradox that the capitalists are the communists. What it becomes is a system of destruction and a system of gathering up the wealth of the world.
And it's a tremendous amount of deception, then.
Oh, absolutely.
So they're creating all different sides, creating fights everywhere, and then coming in to offer the solution to people, which is basically follow them.
One of the things they wanted to do was to horrify people with war. And then they offered themselves up as the solution of world government, that if you eliminate all nations, there will be no more nations left to fight wars. And that would fulfill Jewish messianic prophecy. And that was their objective. So what they did was they made the world very war-weary and then proposed the idea that the way to eliminate wars is to allow the Jewish bankers to form a world government.
Oh, and that's why we're seeing that today, too, because I see that a lot today in message boards even, where the solution to this problem is, of course, world government.
Absolutely.
Under their control, of course.
That was the message of Bolshevism, that the workers of the world would revolt against the monarchies and the bourgeoisie and the capitalistic class and create a world government, and then you would have a utopia. They always promise a utopia, but they always plan for dictatorship and tyranny and absolute destruction.
They're taking advantage of people by offering them these beautiful solutions of love, and we all care for each other, and it's all deception.
Absolutely. It's deliberate deception.
And then the same is true. Would you say they're on both sides of the Republicans and Democrats then?
They always have been, and they were on both sides of the Civil War. The Seligmans controlled the banking interests of the North, while the Rothschild, through August Belmont, controlled the banking interests of the South. And what they were trying to do, which is still going on today, is lure a fight between the French and Mexican Catholics against the Canadian and American Protestants, and create a perpetual war on the North American continent. And the ones who prevented that from happening were the Russians, who had their own banking system. And the Russians threatened that if the Rothschilds fulfilled this plan, they would intervene on behalf of the North. The Rothschild family actually wanted the South to be more successful than it was. And they wanted to bring Mexico up into the South to create a perpetual war between North and South. And somebody is still trying to create strife between American citizens and divide us up between Mexico and Canada. What they wanted to do was to reinstitute the colonial system. And the French had already moved into Mexico, and the pretext was the fact that the Mexican government had not repaid its debts to the Rothschild. And the French used that as a pretext to take over the Mexican government. And they wanted to create a religious and a race war between Catholics and Protestants. And they were very successful doing that on the European continent in the Kulturkampf, where they had the ultramontane Catholics fighting against the Prussian Protestants.
And then would you say that's what's going on right now with this attempt to stir up trouble between the Mexicans that are coming into this country?
It's part of the old plan. And Colonel Edward House had the same plan in his book, Philip Drew Administrator, of creating wars in Mexico. And all that was going on during the First World War, when we were involved with chasing down Pancho Villa and trying to draw Germany into Mexico so that we could have a war with Mexico.
Well, if World War I was supposed to be the war to end all wars and give them their little kingdom, it failed, and then apparently
it failed.
And then they had a World War II, which, again, may have done them some good, but still failed. And so what it looks like is they're trying over and over and over to get this total control. They can't do it. In the meantime, all of us are just suffering tremendously.
They're more patient than that. They realize what's going to happen, and they have contingency plans. The First World War was to break up the empires and to create the idea that small, ethnically segregated nations had a right to their own homeland. And they did that so that the Jews could petition for their own right to a homeland, and at the same time, they wrested Palestine from the Turkish Empire. But when that happened, there was a dispute created between the British and the French over who would own much of Palestine, because Palestine at that time was a part of Syria, and the French had a lot of control over Syrian territories and came into conflict with the British. But the real problem they faced was that the Jews didn't want to go. So what they had to do was to create an anti-Semitic dictator, and they had been planning this since the 1800s. Who would go into Europe and chase the Jews into Palestine.
The 1800s, before the official Zionism movement with Theodor Herzl, you mean?
Zionism is Judaism.
Well, I mean, the official one, as far as most
Herzl
people know.
Herzl was actually late to come on board. Before him were Pinsker and Hess. And before Hess was Judge Noah in America. But the ones behind it all were the Rothschild family, who wanted to be king of the Jews. And the king of the Jews has to rule the world from Jerusalem. There has to be a Jewish kingdom in Israel, or else Judaism is shown to be a mythology.
So the Rothschilds have had this dream since the 1700s? That's when they first started it, you think?
That's when they started the forefront of it. But before that, it was Shabbatai Zevi. Before that, it was Bar Kochba. Before that, it was Moses. This is nothing about this is new. All that is a load of crap.
Oh, I see.
What Herzl tried to say is that this is a political movement. But that in and of itself is in Deutero-Isaiah. Isaiah himself, there are supposedly three different prophets, Isaiah, who composed the book, which is now called Isaiah. And the second of those said that the Jewish people themselves can create a political entity, which is the Messiah. And the objectives of the Messiah are to restore the Jews to Palestine, to destroy all other nations, all other religions, and then all other peoples, and to rule from Jerusalem.
Well, what about the Crusades of the Middle Ages? Are you saying that might even be part of the same plot? Or was
Absolutely.
That something separate?
Because the Crusades were going to wrest Palestine from the Turks.
So hundreds of years ago, there was still that you think it was that same group, not the Christians?
The Christians have always been, and were always planned to be, the servants of the Jews. And this plan is laid out in the initial story of Esau and Jacob. Esau is told that his blessing will be to be a soldier and a slave for Jacob, but that eventually he will break that yoke. Now, that was originally interpreted as Esau broke the yoke when King Nebuchadnezzar sent the Jews into captivity in Babylon. But these same stories keep reappearing in different contexts with different meanings and are conveniently used to justify anything they want to do. But the primary goal has always been to keep the Jewish people segregated, to get them back into Palestine, and to destroy all other peoples. Their religion is absolutely intolerant, and Hindus ought to realize that they are considered idol worshippers and that their altars are to be destroyed and their religion is to be destroyed. Catholics, the same is true, because they worship saints. But they have no love of Protestants or anyone else. There is no other reason for these people to remain segregated and to sacrifice so much and to fight so desperately for that land of Israel other than to fulfill messianic prophecy.
Wow, so this is a very ancient attempt, and it just goes from one group, one family to the next as time goes on then, basically. But
it's Judaism. It's their religion.
And then, of course, the majority of Jews, I suppose, are oblivious to all this then, aren't they?
I would say certainly so. I think they're not only oblivious to it, they're victims of it. But they are also products of it. And they, too many Jews allow themselves to behave tribalistically and defensively and justify immoral behavior on the pretense that it is self-defense when it's not. And they are too willing to take advantage of that excuse to do wrong and to not do right. But there are also many Jews who see Judaism as a divine mission to do right and to be moral. And there are many very fine people who pursue that who are essentially oblivious to the underlying precepts of Judaism.
Well,
I think they simply don't see the plan that is manifest in the prophets.
Well, plus, this is where anti-Semitism comes in handy.
Oh, absolutely.
Without it, there would be no fear from Jews to mingle with the rest of the population. It has to. Without that fear, they would just. There would be harmony.
There would be harmony, and it was the religion itself which operates on fear. They fear God, and they fear God's jealousy. It was racists who created the whole religion in order to keep those people segregated from all other people. And they had a history in Babylon, and the whole religion actually goes back to Egypt and King Akhenaten, and he created monotheism, and he and his people were chased out. They were probably lepers and probably related to the Hyksos, and they apparently migrated to Judah, but there was no Exodus. And then all these stories are essentially the same story told over and over again with different historical figures. And they were all fabricated by Babylonian Jews who wanted to take the land of Canaan from its original inhabitants. From the very beginning, this has been about the theft of land and the segregation of the tribe.
Well, how would you say the Catholic Church fits into any of this? Would you describe them as a completely separate group? Are they victims? Are they infiltrated? How do they fit into it today or in the past?
They were infiltrated by the bankers. And I'm sure that the Spanish popes were corrupt agents of Jewish bankers, and there have been several other popes. And what they would do is run the church into debt. And the French nation was always very wealthy, and at various times the nation of Italy was very wealthy. And they would call upon their people to pay these debts that they had run up. And then the Jewish bankers would use that as a means to reap the wealth of all these nations. And that is why Jewish bankers always try to secure their loans by taxes on the people so that they can enslave those people to become perpetual indentured slaves. And that is what happened to the Catholics. And they have always been trying to destroy the Catholics because the Catholics represent to them Rome. And it was Rome who finally, in 135 A.D., sent the Jews into the final diaspora, into final exile. So they hate the Romans, and they want to exterminate the Romans. And they see the Catholic Church as an extension of the Romans.
The people that are trying to blame all of the world's problems on the Vatican, then, it's just more propaganda to send everyone the wrong direction.
It's nonsense.
Total nonsense.
But there are underlying historical things which can't be forgotten, that the Catholic Church inherited from the Jews the idea of the mystical body of Christ, which meant that Christ had to rule all the nations of the world, and Christ's agent on earth was the Catholic Church, which was the mystical body of Christ. But none of that, all that was completely destroyed with the fall of the Holy Roman Empire. And it was the Kabbalistic Jews who created the Reformation through their agents, John Calvin, whose real name was Cohen, and Martin Luther, who was an agent of the Jews. Now, Martin Luther was viewed as being Elijah or John the Baptist, the one who was predicted to come before the Messiah. And they believed that Martin Luther, by creating the Reformation and splitting the Catholic Church, had prepared the way for the Messiah. And that Messiah, they believed, was, I think his name is Isaac ben Luria, who created the Lurian Kabbalah.
Now you're saying Martin Luther worked for the Jews?
Absolutely.
The same group that you say is trying to take over?
Absolutely.
And so his purpose was to help destroy the Catholic Church, not create another religion?
His purpose was to convert Catholicism into Judaism. That's why they got rid of the saints' worship and the worship of icons and the worship of symbols. All those things that the Reformation movement accomplished were to move Catholicism towards Judaism. And the Jews were slowly and carefully taking over the priesthood in both sects, Catholicism and Protestantism. And the Second Reformation, Puritanism in England, was filled with Jews and manifested itself wherever there was a mixture of Gentiles in a predominantly Jewish community. And you'll notice that the Protestants always name their children with Old Testament Bible names.
Well, now, if you say the Pilgrims...
The Judaization of Catholicism.
If you're saying the Pilgrims and the Protestants were actually Jews, do you mean like crypto-Jews where they are... They're actually working for Jews and sabotaging?
They were. The whole idea of taking over America, and you have to look at the time that it happened, was that the Jews were beginning to assimilate in Spain. And King Ferdinand, I think his father was Jewish. I know he was half Jewish. And they wanted to prevent the assimilation of Jews into Spain. So they passed a law that the Jews either had to convert to Christianity or leave. But at the same time that they did that, they sent Columbus over to America to create the New Jerusalem. And they were going to use America as a new homeland for the Jews and to prepare them and to teach them farming and an agricultural way of life so that they would have a sustainable societal system so that eventually when they were able to get the British and the Russians to fight it out with the Turks and they were able to get Palestine, that they would then have a community who could move to Palestine and be successful. And that plan was ultimately successful. Many of the Jews in Israel were trained in America to become professionals and agricultural people to then go to Palestine and make it a viable state. And they had always planned that the Russian and Polish Jews would be the slave labor force.
But if you're saying they sent Columbus to create a land for Jews, that means they already knew America was there. But how did anybody at that time know America existed?
I think they had known that America existed for a long time since the time of the Vikings. But it wasn't necessarily that they knew that America was there. They were looking for a new homeland for the Jews and new markets for Jewish goods.
Oh, they weren't necessarily expecting to find that land. They were just saying, go out and start looking?
Yes, find us a homeland. They were probably hoping that they would find a desolate land.
Oh, I see. So it wasn't that they knew there was an America. They just said, get out there and start going.
They may have known. I don't know.
But you think it was deliberately, not just for exploration purposes, but to find it was for the Jews?
Yes, it was for the Jews. And there were many Jews on the voyage. And the voyage was financed by Jews. And there were Jews involved in America from the very beginning.
But I remember also hearing that the reason his ship was delayed a couple of days is that they were using the ports to ship Jews out of the area at that particular time.
That may well be. That would fit in. That was going on. And a lot of them ended up in Turkey. And since the Murano idea spread from Turkey to from Spain to Turkey, and after Shabbatai Zevi, they created the Derne-May Turks, who were also crypto-Jews. And who were subversive crypto-Jews who would enter into the Catholic Church and the Muslim faith and became revolutionaries throughout the world. And several Israeli leaders, top leaders, have come from the Derne-May tradition.
Well, if they had this many Jews within the Catholic Church and others that long ago, they must be all over it today, too.
Why do you think the Catholic Church is falling apart?
You think they're all over it and destroying it from the inside?
I think they have been from the beginning. It was Nero's wife who burned Rome and blamed it on the Christians.
Well, what about the popes that are in there right now. I mean, there was one Jewish historian in Britain who thinks that Pope John Paul was part Jewish. Are you even saying that some of these very high-level ones are secretly crypto-Jews? Or just working for them?
It's always been that. And Jews have always been very successful, and it's not unusual that they should have married into those families, especially in Poland, which is why John Paul, I guess he was half Lithuanian, half Polish, would have Jewish blood in him, because they infiltrated the Polish aristocracy in the Catholic Church through Jacob Frank. It's very well known that the Polish royalty are descended from Frankish Jews.
And you think Pope John Paul actually did some harm to the church? Because I thought he was extremely popular and helped expand it, if anything.
I think what he did was, again, to Judaize and popularize Catholicism and to take it away from its initial purpose, which was to proselytize and dominate the world. The Catholic Church adopted from the Jews all those myths that they should proselytize and convert everyone to Catholicism. And they would do it by properties and by selling relief from their sins, which is one of the things that Martin Luther used as a means to subvert the power of the church, the reaction to the corruption. It's very involved, and it's I think it complicates it to speak across a broad range of history, because things change throughout
right.
history.
Yeah.
John Paul and the Catholic Church at this stage do not represent what the Catholic Church was initially meant to be.
So they're transforming it, is the way you see it.
Have been from the beginning. And they also use the Catholics to spread monotheism and infrastructure throughout the world. The Jews learned from their diaspora that when you break up a nation, you send the best of that nation to other countries, and they spread their knowledge and their wealth and their resources to those other countries. And that is one of the reasons they imploded France, and that's one of the reasons they imploded Poland, was in the hopes that these Catholics would go to other parts of the world, colonize, and establish trade routes and churches of monotheism, so that the Jews could then move in and they would not be seen as a threat. They were always the front line. The Catholics were the front line that the Jews would use to convert other peoples to monotheism. That's a very important thing in Judaism, is to destroy all gods but God. Even the Muslims pursue that idea. There is no God but God. And the Trinity idea conflicts with both Islam and with Judaism. But Islam was also created by the Jews as a means to convert other people to monotheism.
Well, Islam was created by Jews. That would have been a long time ago, wouldn't it have been?
It would have been the Prophet Muhammad.
And you're saying he was Jewish?
He may have been or had relations with Jews, but I think he was inspired by Jews, let's put it that way.
Influenced, maybe?
Yes, strongly influenced. Well, you know, they say that they're descended from Abraham through Ishmael. Ishmael was Abraham's first son, and Isaac was his second son. So when Abraham was given the covenant from God, logically it should have passed to Ishmael and not Isaac. Now Isaac descends through Jacob to the Jews, and Ishmael descends through to the Arab peoples, to the Egyptians, and to the Islamic religion. So the Islamic people claim that having the Arabs take over Palestine is what was prophesied and is the promise of the covenant. So they feel they have as much religious right as the Jews do to the land.
Well, actually, I guess both of their religions, you could say, started down in the same area.
Absolutely. That's why the Muslims recognize Christ as a prophet.
Yes. Now, one of the topics your book brings up is Einstein, and my impression of Einstein as a kid was that he was the most intelligent human that's ever existed, and that he has totally transformed physics, And then when I got a little older and I was looking at some of the history of physics, I noticed that there were other physicists such as Lorentz. They were coming up with almost the exact same theories. They just hadn't quite got there. And my impression was Einstein just happened to be in the right place at the right time and put the pieces together and then gets all the credit. You know, sort of like a football team that struggles for a long time to get the ball down to the field, and then at the 1 yard line, some new substitute comes in to replace a player, and he takes the ball over the goal line and gets all the credit, even though he did almost nothing. But your book now is making it look like Einstein truly did nothing at all. Is that a way to describe this situation?
I wouldn't say he did nothing at all, but he doesn't deserve nearly the credit he's given, and he deliberately plagiarized. The person who accomplished what you just described was Jules-Henri Poincaré, who was a French mathematician, the premier mathematician in the world. And he looked at Lorentz's physical theory and saw in it an underlying four-dimensional scheme that could explain the physical phenomenon which had not yet been explained. So he viewed time as a fourth dimension. And Einstein actually opposed the idea that time was a fourth dimension. It was Poincaré who did all the things which are attributed to Einstein in the special theory of relativity.
And you're saying that the reason Einstein gets all the credit is because he was actually a part of this Zionist movement?
Later on, yes. Initially, it was because the theory wasn't that popular. It was because German nationalists viewed Einstein as a good German and they wanted to give him credit. It was because Poincaré was a very gracious person. And it was because the German publishing houses were mostly owned by Jews and they were very tribalistic and very unfair to Poincaré. Theoretical physics wasn't that important until Einstein was made a superstar, so it wasn't that big of a deal.
Oh, back in those days, they were like a fringe group, huh?
Yes, very much so. And these ideas were fringe ideas. They were not popular. It was not until 1919, when Einstein was made a superstar based on false evidence, that all this really became an issue. There were a lot of people, from 1905 onward, people were pointing out the fact that Einstein had repeated the work of these other people without giving them an attribution.
So this is like well known. It's not even a debatable issue, really, then.
Absolutely. Only dishonest people would debate it.
And then that explains why he never got the Nobel Prize for his theory of relativity.
Yes. There was a man named Philip Lenard, who may have been a crypto Jew. Some people have said that he was of Jewish descent. But Einstein, of course, accused him of plagiarism so he could hide from the fact. Accused him of anti-Semitism so that he could hide from the fact. But Philip Lenard knew some of, I think, Sven Hayden, or what, I forget his name at the moment, but one of the Nobel Prize judges, and he let him know that Einstein had plagiarized this theory. But there were other issues with the Nobel Prize. It was not meant to be awarded for theories. It was meant to be awarded for scientific discovery so that it could promote the advancement of technological progress. So they broke all kinds of rules by trying to give Einstein the prize, but they could never resolve how to do it. So they eventually just said, we'll give it to him for his outstanding accomplishments in physics and we'll mention the photoelectric effect.
You know, what it reminds me of is when they, after 9/11, we're told Osama bin Laden did the attack, but then you look at the FBI's most wanted list and he's listed for something else. And so here we have Einstein, supposedly the most brilliant man, creates this theory, but that's not what he's given an award for?
And he also broke the rules. He was to give a speech, and the rules held that I think the speech had to be given in Gothenburg or in Stockholm, and he gave it in Gothenburg one way or the other. And it had to be on that which he was awarded the prize for, but instead he gave it on the theory of relativity. So the public received the false impression that he was being given the Nobel Prize for the theory of relativity when he absolutely and specifically was not being given it for the special theory of relativity. Or the theory of relativity generally.
And now in your book, you're also saying that this is partly a promotion by the Zionists to...
Absolutely. It was admitted by Einstein and his friends that they were going to call him the Jewish Newton and that he would be a spokesman for Zionism and spread Zionist propaganda.
He has admitted this in writing, you mean?
Yes. Not only he, but many of the people around him. Justice Brandeis even said that it's a good thing that this Jew is going to come and show the rest of the world that the Jews are doing all the important things in the world.
So it was to boost the image of Jews worldwide.
Absolutely. But you have to look on the fact that tragically Jews had always been accused of being uncreative. From ancient times, an Egyptian named Apion said that the Jews produced nothing creative. They produce no culture, they produce no science, they produce no music. And that nerve was touched again by Vishat Bogner when he said that the Jews are completely incapable of producing high-quality literature, music, or science. And then another man named Houston Stuart Chamberlain falsely accused the Jews of being genetically unable to produce any great people on the level of Newton or Mozart or Bach or Wagner, that they could not compete in those arenas. And the Jews wanted to break that mythology, and they went overboard and pushed the idea that Karl Marx, Sigmund Freud, and Albert Einstein were the greatest minds that humanity had ever produced, that they could put an end to that mythology that the Jews were incapable of producing great people.
It's funny you should mention Karl Marx and Sigmund Freud, because there's a book, The Jewish Mystique, that uses those same people as evidence of how great they are. But I mean, would most people
all
even
contrive to confront the mythology that Jews are incapable of producing geniuses? There was a guy, I think his name was Gobineau, and he created that mythology that all great people in history had been Aryan, and that the Jews were incapable of creating great people and would have to, through theft and plagiarism, copy others. They were good copycats, but they produced no original greats. And that Gobineau mythology, the Jews responded, Jewish leadership responded to it by creating an alternative mythology that they had produced the most wonderful minds that most heavily influenced the 20th century. But the thing that influenced the greatest influence on the 20th century was Jewish control over the mass media and politics. And both of those were results of the Rothschild fortunes, which they obtained by perpetual war and by central banking.
Now, the Nobel Prizes, from what I understand, the way they find new people for the prizes is they ask the previous winners. So if there was one Zionist who gets into this as the Nobel Prize winner, and they start asking him for suggestions on who should win, he would likely name another Zionist. And, you know, after a while, you could end up, the whole place is dominated by them. Do you see the Nobel Prizes as even being...
In some instances, they've been justified, but I think there has been unfair Jewish bias. I think there's been an unfair German bias. And I think there's been an unfair Northern European bias. It isn't only the Jews who have this elitism and prejudice. Northern Europeans have the same problem.
Well, if they're asking who to recommend, they're likely recommending people.
It's not only that, but Einstein is a classic example of Jewish tribalism, where when professorships come up, he would recommend his Jewish friends who supported his theory. And when Jewish reporters wanted to write stories about the conflicts that he entered into, they would not go to the people who were opposed to him. They would go to his Jewish friends who would lie about what was going on, deliberately lie and distort the news. And then these Jewish reporters would feel confident about lying to the public about what was going on. And it was specifically Jewish-run, Jewish-edited, Jewish-reported newspapers that defamed all of Einstein's critics as if they were anti-Semites. And many of these people were Nobel Prize-winning physicists. Philip Lenard had won the Nobel Prize in physics, and he was Einstein's chief critic. And he's the one who prevented Einstein from getting the Nobel Prize for the theory of relativity. And the one who pushed for the idea that it should be the photoelectric effect was Osseus. And he had to fabricate it as an excuse. It was a rather minor thing, and Robert Millikan was already scheduled to win the prize for it. and they had to delay his prize, and they gave him the prize for the exact same thing the next year, and he kept his mouth shut about it, even though he said Einstein's theory was untenable.
Do you have any last suggestions for people who are going to read this book, how it might apply to them now, and what...
I don't want to give them the false impression that it's all about physics and that it's untouchable and not understandable. I'd like to let them know that the majority of the book, especially the initial chapters, are about Jewish racism, about Zionism, about Judaism. They rely only on the facts and not on my opinions, and that everything in the book is verifiable, and I suggest that people, if they are incredulous, investigate it, try to verify it, and they'll see that what I'm saying is true, and then they ought to listen to my critics and get their feedback and then arrive at their own conclusions. But I think they'll find in my book a great deal of evidence that they won't find elsewhere, and some very rare documentation, which is reproduced in my book, that they would never become aware of otherwise. And I hope it's helpful to people. And when people are told that when they say these things, but they offer up no proof, I hope that they can look to my book to find some of that proof to back up what they're claiming.
And these old newspaper articles, where did you find them? Are they still available somewhere in maybe museums or libraries?
Fortunately, a lot of them are being digitized and are searchable, but you have to know what to look for. And newspaper articles often reference other newspaper articles, and in books, many people who have been criticized or smeared complain about certain newspapers or certain articles which smeared them. And it's a process of going through all that to get at the material and then to sort through it and to see what's valuable and what's not, and to see what's been misrepresented and what's been accurately represented.
But basically all the ones you've found, they're still available. They're actually, it's not like they've been lost and you've got...
No, I have... There may be some of the things I quote which are down to about 5 copies worldwide, but it is verifiable. I'm not producing any unique things which can't be verified. A lot of this stuff is on microfilm, and a lot of it is in digitized archives, and a lot of it is still available as hard copies.